Welcome, everyone, to a Life Worth Living podcast with Dr. Foye, sponsored by Lifesavers Emergency Room. Today, we have an awesome friend of mine, Dr. Simi Dele Ayeni. Dr. Simi is a pediatrician here in Houston, Texas, and she is going to share with us just some tips on taking care of our children, trusting our pediatricians, and some of the challenges and things that she navigates through in trying to provide excellent care to our community. So Dr. Simi, welcome to A Life Worth Living podcast. Thank you so much for honoring our invitation.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for an opportunity to talk to our folks a little bit about what it means to be taking care of kiddos these days. Thank you, Dr. Foye.
Awesome. Well, so generally, we'll ask you some questions that we've prepared ahead of time. But a lot of times I, as a mother with kids who does visit the pediatrician often, I have questions myself. So I'm going to throw those in there periodically. But first, if you can introduce yourself and share a little bit about your background in pediatrics, what led you, what inspired you to become a pediatrician, when you looked at all the possible fields. You chose kids.
I know, right? I know.
What led to that with your education? And
perfect. Thanks. So I grew up in Maryland, right outside DC, and did all my early schooling in that area. When it came time to select an undergraduate university, I was ready to get out of Dodge, right? I was like, I'm leaving my parents' house. I'm leaving Maryland. And so I looked at a lot of different schools. And I also was even considering engineering at a point. So I kind of was, definitely science oriented, right? I had gone to a high school where we had an intense STEM program and I was interested in it. It was nothing, no pressure from my parents, just what I was interested in. And so I applied to schools like Carnegie Mellon and MIT because I was still thinking engineering. But I also applied to obviously all my local schools, Maryland schools. And along the way, I came across a scholarship program. And this scholarship program just completely took over. And that became my goal. That was what I wanted. And so that program is housed at UMBC. So University of Maryland, Baltimore County, the Meyerhoff Scholarship Program. It was established to increase the number of African Americans in STEM fields. And so that was in the late 80s, the program was established. And so I caught wind of this program and I was like, I want to be at UMBC. So my focus changed. By the end of senior year of high school, I kind of figured, okay, I think I don't want to do engineering. I think I want to do medicine. I was really going into college pre-med. So by that point, I kind of knew what I wanted to study and I fell in love with the scholarship program. Fortunately, I was awarded the scholarship. I was super excited. And so I wound up staying in state. And I tell that story a lot because sometimes I look at my seniors and I get it. Everyone wants to leave home, do their own thing. But there is some benefit sometimes to staying in state. And so I wound up doing that. And while at UMBC, I was a biochemistry major, completed all my pre-med requirements, and also did a lot of research. So I really got interested in MD, PhD programs. And I applied to those as I was finishing up undergraduate career. And I was accepted into the MD, PhD program at University of Alabama in Birmingham. So I moved down south for my training, for med school, for graduate school. And that was where I was for about, 8, 9 years, completing an MD degree, as well as a PhD in microbiology. And so along the way, medical school years, we think about what do we want to study, what field do we want to go into. And I quickly kind of ruled out surgical specialty. I was not an OR type of person. So I quickly realized that and then was trying to decide, did I want to take care of adults or did I want to take care of children? And I thought about both. I actually thought about doing med peds for some time, but I just felt like, okay, just pick one thing in your life for once. I think I struggle with decisions sometimes. And as I thought about the two, I said, well, as a pediatrician, I can impact a family because I have my patient, but I also have that get the guardians for that patient, whether it's mom and dad, whether it's grandma, whether it's auntie, whoever it may be, right? And I said, okay, this is how one can impact families. And I really did think about it. I remember being at UAB thinking that. And so that was what led me to choose pediatrics. There are some pediatricians who absolutely hate adults, right? They don't want to do adult medicine. I was not really one of those. I actually really enjoyed ICU. I remember my medical ICU rotation. I thought the physiology was fascinating. But I said, okay, pick one thing. And I think for the greater sort of impacting a community, I thought of pediatrics.
I think that's amazing that you actually want to impact the community. I think some people choose pediatrics because it's like, well, I don't want adults, so here we are, and then some people love the kids, but they don't necessarily enjoy the family aspect of it. Like, I want to treat the sick kid, but I'm also you know, inadvertently treating the whole family because I need them to understand a lot of things to be able to help me take care of this child when they go home. So you actually went into it for all the right reasons, which is that you want to treat the whole family and have an impact on the family. So that's awesome. I need all pediatricians to have that same kind of enthusiasm.
Yeah, that was sort of my thinking. So that's how I got to where I am.
Well, tell me about, well, residency is only focused on pediatrics, and do you stop at 18, or are there certain types of patients that you continue to work and learn about through over the age of 18? Like if they've had pediatric conditions that are going on, and what's the cutoff?
Yeah, perfect. So good question. And I think that's going to be, you know, a little bit independent, depending on the dynamic, but we're getting to that stage. And this is nice because it'll help us talk a little bit about the advancement of medicine. So there's so many conditions, right? 50 years ago, 100 years ago, children were not surviving, right? Whether it be sickle cell disease, cystic fibrosis, congenital heart disease, right? So these children, unfortunately, with the conditions they were born with, it made it challenging. But thank God medicine has really advanced where children are born with these conditions and they can live a long, healthy life, right? With good care, with good medical support. And so, yes, the classic 0 to 18, but what you'll, you know, in terms of who we take care of, ages 0 to 18, but what you'll see is that with some of the subspecialists, the children who are born with these conditions, they will maintain that relationship for many more years and for so many reasons, right? They've seen this team of doctors since they were little. And, you know, they reach 18 and it's like, you want me to go where? You want me to do what? But we're getting better also at the transition, right? So as we have more med peds trained physicians or physicians who are trained and interested in that period, that transition period specifically, right? Helping maybe a child who has to follow with a team of subspecialists make that move into the adult world. So I think that's what we see now as in terms of pediatric residency. It is specifically, you know, sort of ages 0 to 18, right? We start with newborn nursery, NICU care. So caring for the child as soon as they come out, right? Were they full term? Were they premature? Was there any, you know, so we know we hit those issues immediately and we just progress through looking at development. There's developmental pediatrics and all the way to the transition to the adulthood. So residency will prepare you. Pediatric residency will prepare you to be able to do just that. Take care of the child from birth until they transition to adulthood. And so some of our specialists will see kids a little bit into their early 20s just because of that bond, just because of that relationship. And then they understand that anatomy the best, right? I mean, you have congenital heart disease, you've had various surgeries to correct, and that cardiologist team is the one that knows your heart the best.
So even as a general pediatrician, do you still see patients above the age of 18 if you've been with them for a while, or do they gently?
Yes, I know. It's a tough conversation. A lot of them are like, but no, we don't want to leave. And, you know, I sort of just gently remind them that, you know, you have to move on to a doctor that will be able to help you with the issues that will come up as you get older. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I look at, I've been in practice for, oh gosh, about 7 years now, almost 8. So I haven't had a full, you know, long span, but I've had some children that I've seen for 1 or 2 years as they're high school students and then they graduate. And it's like, oh, but what do? I want to see you. And I just have a conversation with them that, you know, it's time to move on. It's time for you to, you know, seek out a doctor that's going to be able to support you as you transition. So it is a tough conversation. And you know, I'm excited because I'm so happy that they've graduated and we talk about that and what they want to go on and do in the world. So it's fun, but it is a little, you know, it's sad to see them move on, but they understand.
Let's talk a little bit about health issues and sort of your bread and butter pediatrics. What would you say? What would you say are the most common conditions that come into the clinic? And then what would you say are more of the terrible day conditions that would come into the clinic for you?
Okay, well, so our job is to care for the child from birth. So a lot of what I do is just that well child checkups, right? So ensuring that the child is meeting milestones when we expect them to, ensuring that we're seeing appropriate growth, right? We measure their head size, we take their weight, we take their height, we do various screens in terms of asking the parents, have you seen this? What are some of the behavior you've seen? What are some of the behaviors you've seen? Do you have any concerns about your child's behavior? How was that transition from into kindergarten, right? So universally, a five-year-old child will be in kindergarten. Some have gone to preschool, some may have not. They may have been with mom all, you know, for 4 or 5 years. How's that transition going? So that's my bread and butter, well child checkups. Even into senior, you know, into the teenage years, adolescence, transition puberty. So recognizing and ensuring that the child is meeting where is developing as we would expect them to, right? So that's one thing. And then helping families through those transitions, guiding the first-time mom through breastfeeding. Right. Once she leaves the hospital, then she's in my office every 2 weeks and every 2 months, you know, for almost 2 years, right? 2 to 3 months for almost 2 years. And so we guide them through a lot of those initial questions that families may have. And then I think about, again, the transition to school and guiding them through that process. Vaccinations are part of our well child exams, developmental screenings, as I mentioned. And so those are kind of, that's the bread and butter. Then there's when the child is sick. When the child is not healthy, right? That is the next big thing. And I would say the biggest thing we're going to see is sort of upper respiratory infections. I think those are the most common things. So disease from upper respiratory germs, including ear infections, eye symptoms, chest symptoms.
I have a question about that. Is it okay? Important to know what the, there's so many, but there's RSV, there's adenovirus, there's, you know, flu, there's, well, now we have COVID. Now, you know, I mean, there's a gamut of viruses out here. Do you find that patients want to know which one it is? Like, is it important for people to know? And then given that there's not necessarily a cure for all of these viruses, do you guys help with that education for them?
Perfect. Good question. People do want to know. Parents do want to know. And it's hard. It's hard because I have to explain to them that irregardless of the cause of the symptoms, what's the etiology of this disease, irregardless of that, I know how to manage this. And I know what signs I'm looking for. I can walk into the room and know this child's going to go home, right? I can walk into the room and know that. I can walk into a room and say, I may be transferring this child to the emergency room, you know, and that's even after my MAs have, my medical assistants have roomed them and they're kind of like, oh, we noticed these vitals. Can you, you know, stick your head in this room a little bit early, right? Those kinds of things. So it is important, but I try to guide them through the process to help them realize that the etiology doesn't make a difference. These are the things I'm looking for. These are the things we can do to help manage and help get the child through this illness. And a lot of them will accept that for me, you know. You talked about a little bit earlier, people come to me with different expectations. I don't know what is in that child's, that parent's mind or that auntie's mind or that godfather's mind. I have no clue. Right. And sometimes there are other issues going on. But when I realize in the encounter that, okay, I'm saying these things, it's not quite hitting home. I can see it in their facial expression. I can see it in their body language. They're not quite feeling me yet, right? And so I have to, then you just say directly, tell me what it is that you might be worried about. You know, because I try to think about these things, but you don't know. They might be thinking about their neighbor who just 2 days ago, their neighbor's child was admitted to the ICU. And, you know, here I am saying, oh, you just have a runny nose, go home. But if I can understand that context, I can see why they might be so anxious, right?
Explain, well, tell me more. Okay, that this and this. Well, this, you don't have that.
Yes, exactly. So it's tricky. It's tricky. But, you know, I do appreciate, people will understand. And I think I've gotten, you know, I've gotten used to the idea of explaining to them, well, I'm not going to test for that today because honestly, we don't even have the test. And I often will tell them that as an experienced pediatrician, I don't need the test. You know, this is what I can pick up on.
There are some places that will do the test. Like
they will.
Of it, but there's one, it's like a 25 or 30 panel. And we did have it in our ER at one point, but it became really unnecessary because it was really, you know, you're going to treat the same way. It's really ears, NEBS, you know, so it really was really unnecessary to tell the patient, we're going to run 25 tests on you. And you're going to, obviously you may get a bill. And now you know, but would it have changed anything? You know, so I can definitely, it's something I always wonder about because we have patients that come in and they really want to know because the main things now that we test for is flu and COVID, stress, RSV. After that, I'm like, you just got one of the bugs.
You know? Exactly.
Which one is it? You know, what is it?
Yeah. You're exactly right. And yes, you're right. Those tests are available and they can be helpful. They can be helpful. But again, you look at the patient. That's your that's what you have, right? Your history and physical, the things we learn, you know, in those first few years of medical school, you stick to that and you know that, okay, this is why I don't need a test. And sometimes it's harder to convince the parent than others, but, you know, we definitely do our best.
All right. So tell me a little bit about the regular pediatric checkups. How important is that? I know that in schools, they do require that students provide some sort of clearance from their physician that they've been seeing, they have their vaccines and those kind of things. Do you feel that having that in place by the schools help catch a lot of diseases, developmental issues, things like that for you providers?
Yes, so good question. It is nice when that is required, right? So most states will still have immunization requirements that are needed to enter the school. And so for that reason, a family might, you know, show up in our clinic, right? Even if it's for that reason alone, they say, oh, my child is healthy. We've never had to go to the ER, never had to go do anything, but apparently we need to get some vaccines, you know, get caught up on some vaccines. And yes, I think that's fine. I think that's helpful. But like you know, sort of you alluded to, part of what we're doing is also looking for things that are irregular, things that are abnormal. And there are many things that one can walk around with for quite some time, and there's an underlying problem, but we don't know, right? And so that is why I think it is, you know, it's so important for children to stay up to date on their annual checkup after those initial first 4 or 5 years where the vaccine schedule is a bit intense. Frequent is what I want to say. The visits are frequent to make sure you stay caught up. But I remind families that once a year, bring them in for a checkup around their birthday or during summer vacation before school starts. I remind families to do that because, again, sometimes there are things that are going on that the family has no idea about, especially as the child gets older. I can recall a few encounters, and this was right in the heat of lockdowns in the face of, you know, the pandemic. I had some patients showing up with self-injury, and the parents had no clue. We were discovering those injuries in my office. And it was only because I insisted, you know, I have my ways of trying to look at their arms, look at their, and I noticed these, and I noticed something, and then I look to myself and I look at the patient. And I say, okay, this encounter is going to be a little bit longer than we anticipated. And we go right into it. And thankfully we did, because it brings up the challenges that patient, that child was having, and mom and dad were unaware. Mm-hmm. And so we can address it. We can come up with a plan. We can figure out what was it that triggered this? How do we need to work through this so that it doesn't escalate? And that's just one example. I love another example. The one I thought of is our very basic. So it's very common for children to be slightly anemic as they transition from formula or breast milk into maybe whole milk and regular food. It's sort of, you know, it's physiologic. And we look for that. We pay attention to it. We fortify formulas, you know, for some of those reasons, right? And but sometimes the anemia can still be there. If we didn't screen, I wouldn't be able to catch it, right? But it's something that I can easily intervene in. I say, okay, we're going to start this iron supplement. And these numbers are going to get better. We don't have to worry. But the child physically is fine running around the room, running around at home. And they eat, but I think there's just that physiologic change along with maybe what, how exactly the diet was and, you know, what the family transitioned to. Sometimes it's a little bit worse for some of my kiddos than others. And we do need to supplement. So very simple things. But if you didn't come into the doctor, we would never know.
So tell me what it's like treating the child and the parent. Do you have to give time or a lot of time to be able to explain everything to the child to make them, and then also provide adult version of that to the caretaker in the room?
Yes, you're exactly right. It's tricky sometimes. It can be challenging, but, you know, we work through it. I look for those signs of, oh, you know, I can talk to my families, and sometimes I see the light just went on. The light just came on. They get where I'm going with this. And so I look for those kinds of things to make sure they're understanding. You know, to the parents' credit, most parents will do whatever they need to do for their child. While they won't listen to you, who's guiding them about their hypertension or their headache management, right? They won't take care of themselves, but they will often listen to their pediatrician for the sake of that child. So that is one of the things that I think is a little bit of a bonus for us.
How do you help parents not feel necessarily ashamed or judged? Because there's some things that are just by omission. You didn't notice the cuts, or you didn't notice. Mm-hmm. Maybe you got them the script or you got them the medicine, but you weren't supervising them taking their medication. And so now they're not better. You know, so there can be a lot of shame associated with bringing your child in for not getting better or being sick and feeling like, oh, if I'd just done this, or if I'd spent more time.
That's a good point. That's a good point. So I try to help the families realize that they're not alone. I think that's one of the biggest things. You know, in our little family world, it's me, my three children, my two children, my one child. So everything seems like, oh my gosh, I must be so bad. This is what, you know, I can't believe I'm in this situation, right? The parent might say that to themselves. But because I see scores of children every day, I let them know that you are not alone. This is something that we are seeing that is a general problem. It's a general challenge. And as a body, we recognize it. And these are the things we've actually implemented to try to address some of these challenges. So one of the things I really try to let families know is that you're not alone in this. Sometimes I have to counsel a family on a referral for mental health support, right? So whether it's a counselor or a psychiatrist or a therapist, I think would benefit the child. And we all know that mental health still carries a bit of stigma. It's getting better, I think, but it still carries stigma. So it's a hard conversation for a lot of people, right? But when I bring that up, I let them know that I refer people to some of these centers all the time. I actually, you know, take my time to let them know that I have patients. I use the word friend. I say, I have friends that have gone to see some of these people once a week, once a month. You know, they do it for 6 months. I have some that have done it for 2-3 years. Whatever is going to work for you. But I don't want you to think that this is only, this is such a huge problem. No, it's actually more common than you think. We just don't talk about it, right? And then some of the other perspective I like to give families is, let's deal with this now before the child leaves your home and is out of your hands. If you have asthma, I need to make sure you can manage. You're going to remember your steroid inhaler every day. You're going to remember to look out for when things are changing. So when I bring in that perspective as well, that this is not just something I'm doing, you know, this is because we need to prepare them to be independent. So that's another way I try to help them realize that, please don't feel bad about what has happened. The good thing is it happened under your care. They'll be better prepared when they're not, when you can't be around them constantly, right? And then to help them realize that they are not alone. A lot of families are dealing with some of the same challenges. As a mom, I bring myself it. Oh my gosh, that's one of the other biggest things I can do. I let the, you know, a lot, and sometimes I can see them kind of, you know, well, I have a son around this age and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you just see them kind of,
you're doing the same things.
Exactly. And I let them know that, hey, I had to deal with the same thing. Sometimes I'll say, well, you know, when my daughter was so-and-so age, I had to deal with the same thing. This is how I managed it. Well, that helps a lot too.
So tell me, why do you think people are worried about vaccines or scared of vaccines? Why do we generally have a distrust for vaccines?
Yes, good question. I think challenges we're having with our vaccination rates in the country, there are a few reasons. There are a few different reasons. And I think one of the important ones is this idea that there are things in the vaccines that lead to other problems, right? That lead to problems. I think that's sort of one of the biggest things when I'm getting a little bit of pushback, or this is what, you know, yeah, this is what I'm getting back. And so there was, a big challenge or issue whereby, someone published that, vaccines are associated with, you know, development of autism, right? And that was something that has since been debunked. It has been published in that same medical literature that these studies were not real, these studies were not dependable, and this is not the case. But, you know, people take that and they use that as sound bites. And I think in this world of social media, where information is coming in all forms and all directions at people, their voice got louder than ours, to be very honest. As a body, their voice got louder than the doctors, and that's unfortunate. And so now we're trying to sort of, you know, come back and fight against that. Then there's the idea that, I didn't get so many vaccines when I was a child. Why does my child need so many vaccines? Well, actually, you probably don't remember, and you probably did, because to be very honest, there's only a few that have come up within the last, let's say, 20 years. The other ones were there. So I don't know where that idea comes from. I can name the few that are, you know, within the last, let's say, 25 years, you know, were not available. So that's one thing. Unfortunately, what I've realized in the last few years is that, and it's so unfortunate, because of vaccines, we don't see so many diseases. We don't see complications from certain infections. And so people think they don't exist. And I think that's the biggest error we can make. Just because you don't see polio this causing, you know, debilitating disease does not mean that it doesn't exist and it could not still happen. It's because of vaccines that you don't see those things, right? Measles related encephalitis was a big problem, you know, years ago. We don't see that anymore because of the vaccine. So it's unfortunate that we've gotten to a state where if I don't see it, it's not real, or it doesn't exist, or it's not a problem I need to worry about. I don't know how we got there.
It's reduced significantly.
Yes. I don't know how we got there.
I think some of the people that are anti-vaccine now are benefiting from herd immunity. So because nobody around them is getting it or catching it, they're not exposed to it. And so they're protected. And so they can still run with that idea that a vaccine is not necessary. But they're the little black sheep inside the fold that's protected. So
yes,
all that education is something I'm sure you have to go through every day.
You know, I do my best. I won't lie, because there are times where you know that whatever I say is not changing the situation. You know, I get that a lot. And so I see the patient, you know, because they come for their routine checkups and I bring it up. I bring it up, you know, at each visit. And then the other thing we try to work on is building that trust. Oh, I can think of a conversation I had recently, you know, newborn baby. So follow up from the hospital. And I saw on the discharge paperwork that so the first vaccine is your hepatitis B, as you know, on your first or second day of life. And so when I review the discharge paperwork from the hospital, I can see, did this baby receive that or not? So I kind of get a sense of, okay, where the family's going, right? Or at least a little bit of a clue. And so, you know, I didn't bring it up that first visit. You know, I left it alone. I said, okay. And then the second visit, then, you know, and because also I was meeting the family for the first time. This is not a family where I had taken care of other siblings. This is not a family that maybe I met during a prenatal visit. You know, mom came to seek me out before she had the baby. I was meeting them for the first time. And I said, okay, let's establish a relation. Let's build some rapport together, right? Let's focus on the other issues that are super important right now, as in fever in a neonate, as in managing the baby's weight loss and how do we make sure the baby's breastfed or formula fed and everything's well, and managing bilirubin if we need to do that. Let's focus on the other things, right? And so around that third visit was when I brought it up. And it was a really nice outcome, because I had a chance to talk to her about what her own fears were. And if I had to guess from day one, I don't think I would have come up with that. And I think it helped our relationship. So she explained to me what her concern was. And then I countered and I let her know that, well, these are the things that we have studied and we know not to be true about vaccine products. And I said, but I understand your hesitancy. And so what we're going to do is we're going to continue to work through it. We're going to continue to talk about it. And I think that helped our relationship, you know, as opposed to me coming down with a hammerhead that, oh, you need to do this. I straight up asked, what is it about the vaccine that you're concerned about? Let's talk about it now. And that was on visit three, after we've talked about some of the other things. So I think I'm learning as I go.
Eventually get her child vaccinated or no?
So the baby's still young. The baby's still young.
You're not only talking to her, you know, sometimes this is a family decision. This could be mom, grandma as well. This could be, you know, other people in the family have collectively made this decision. And so the person you're talking to may not even be the decision maker, and you'll never get a change in opinion, change in mind, because it's not just them. You're only seeing her, but you know what I mean? That there's other.
Thank you, Dr. Foya. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly right, because that's happened. And what they'll tell me is, well, my husband or the baby's father or my partner, who you're exactly right. And I've had those scenarios as well. So it is a challenge. We do our best to make sure. And, they sometimes families will come in and they'll ask, oh, what about this vaccine? And one of the things I say, and I say this very routinely out of my mouth, I support all vaccines. And I say, because I understand the immunology behind them. I understand. And then I recognize that the purpose of this immunization is to protect your child if they were to be exposed to this infection, you know, to a certain disease that can be debilitating. So I'm not, you know, and I let them know that I'm not saying they couldn't catch it. You know, our flu vaccine is sort of my best example for that. Every flu season, you could still catch the flu, but you getting that flu vaccine, I've seen that, having worked in urgent care, having worked in primary care, it helps. It helps those people to recover a bit faster. I let them know that I'm a fan of all vaccinations.
Exactly. Even with COVID, especially flu, those patients,
yes,
they're better in a few days. They're not the hospitalized group. They're not getting pneumonias. And I think even those who've had the vaccine, they can remember the times they haven't had the vaccine and how they felt without the vaccine with that infection. You know, tell me about this, though. What about patients who've had the vaccine, who got the vaccine, and a few days later, they say, the vaccine gave me the flu?
I love that. I get that a lot. How do I respond?
Receipts. And I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure it didn't, because it's inactivated. These are proteins. Maybe, you know, so what do you tell patients who say that?
And yes, sick. You're right. I let them know that, well, first of all, you cannot get the infection from the vaccine because we only give you a piece of this virus so your body can recognize it, right? So I kind of help them realize that. Remember, there's a whole germ that has to invade your body. When I give you that vaccine, I'm just giving you a small piece so that the body can recognize that germ if it were to see it later. That's one of the ways that I'll, you know, explain it to families is no. I said, now what did happen was your immune system sensed something foreign, which is what it's supposed to do, and you had a slight reaction to it. And sometimes I'll bring in some of my colleagues who, no matter what they do, they always react, you know, to the vaccine. And I'd say that, you know, and she's a physician. I say that, well, that's because her immune system recognizes it, but in 2 days, she's going to be fine. So I try to use, again, a little bit of a personal experience, and I remind them the science behind it. And you're right, some minds don't get changed, but, you know, we do our best.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you for explaining. And for anybody who is listening, definitely having the vaccine, you may develop a reaction, and it's just an immune reaction. Your body is reacting to this foreign protein, but you're not catching the virus. The flu vaccine cannot give you the flu. The COVID vaccine cannot give you COVID. I know even with COVID, the COVID vaccine, you may have a reaction for a few days and it might put you down, like muscle aches, body aches, you know, fatigue, but you don't have COVID, you know? So, and I think that's even, I've even talked to doctors who believe it. So it's definitely this myth that goes around that people say all the time. Can you tell us a little bit about developmental milestones should parents be aware of with kids at the age of 1, 2? And is that something you go over with parents periodically?
Oh, yes. We go over every visit and, you know, those first few years of life. There is something that we're looking for, even that 1 month old to do, that 2 month old, I'm asking questions. So we go over that every well child visit, I would say under the age of 5 for sure. And we continue to assess developments and mental health, even older, right? So one of the tools we use for screening, so we basically ask the families to maybe fill out a sheet. And we give them an opportunity to write down what are their concerns, right? Do they have any concerns? So I think that's important. Sometimes we're talking so much, I don't get to receive from them. And that's because I'm trying to cover so much information, right? But also letting them explain to me, this is what I've noticed. This is my concern. So that's one way. We have a questionnaire for that. And then we ask specific questions, looking for the infant to smile at 2 months of age, right? Looking for the baby to be able to sit independently at 6 months of age. So there are very specific milestones that we check in various areas. So motor skills, social skills, language skills, for these things all throughout those first few years of life. And you're right. There are things that we're looking for in terms, and the reason we're doing this is because if there's a problem, if there's a delay, what do we need to do to address it? And a lot of the times it's very simple. We need to initiate some form of therapy. I sometimes use the analogy with my patients that if you have an ankle sprain and it's severe and you're on crutches and you're in pain, one of the things that, you know, they might recommend is physical therapy. And it can't hurt. That will heal. It will get better. But therapy cannot hurt. And sometimes people are hesitant because they think, oh, well, we just want to wait and see. And that's why I bring that up. Wait and see. Okay. But why not start something that cannot hurt?
So how early can you start therapy? What age would you say would be the youngest you can start ABA therapy?
Okay. So that's something you just brought up. I would say that I do not have any problem referring a child for a delay by 12 months. I often will observe for a few more months to 15 months is sort of my cutoff. If I don't see what I expect, I'm going to at least refer you to speech therapy. Okay. And that's what I'm referring to. And the specific skill we're talking about here is language development, right? So if I'm not seeing that the child is developing appropriately in terms of how they're communicating, speech therapy is one of the first things I can help. I can, you know, bring up so that we can help this patient, right? Help my child. And so at 12 months, it's a little tricky, I think, still. But if you see other things, because not like I see eye interaction, right? Does the patient, you know, look me in the eye? Does the patient look for mom in the room? So I can have a child on the exam table and I'm examining that patient and they really are sort of oblivious to their parents in the room. I've seen that. You know, they aren't making direct eye contact with me. And this is a little bit atypical for a 12-month-old. Okay, this is atypical. And so there are many things we can look for. And if we see something, yes, then there isn't too young of an age. I think the sooner the better. But I would say definitely by 15 months of age, if you don't think your child is communicating in the way you would expect, you need to have a conversation with your pediatrician about it. And let's do something about it. Because I've had people come to me and tell me something like, and this child is already maybe 2 years old at this point. But what they said was, oh, you know, well, my family said that sometimes it takes a while for the baby to talk. Or I had some families who felt like because of the COVID lockdown and they didn't go out as much, that was a reason the baby wasn't talking. No, those things will not be a reason that that child should not communicate. They may be a little bit more, they may have more stranger anxiety, you know, there are other things, but that does not stop that child from speaking one or two words at age one, 5 to 10 words, you know, by age 15 months. That should not change that, or 18 months. So I have to help the families realize also sometimes that I understand what you're saying, but that is not a reason this child should not be able to, you know, communicate in the way we would expect.
Tell me a little bit about autism. Where is all this autism coming from? Is it our food? Is our exposure? So I've heard people say things about the environment, the plastics in the water, the Tylenol, like just so many different theories out here. Where do you think it's coming from? How does it impact your practice?
It impacts my practice quite a bit. So as a resident, we are trained in, you know, recognizing developmental delay as part of what we do. We complete a rotation actually at the development center that we have in town. So I did my residency here in town. So when I refer to these things, it's because I've been in Houston for some time now. We spend time to learn about these things. And when I got out into practice, I was seeing it way more than I ever anticipated. I really just did not think I would see that much delay. I was ready for it. I was, you know, we know it exists. There are certain conditions that are associated with developmental delay. There are genetic conditions where we know these things might occur, but there are you know, I felt like I found myself where there was, you know, no genetic concern, at least prenatally or, you know, immediately after birth. There were no signs, physical signs on exam that, oh, maybe we need to refer you to genetics for testing because I see this, this, and this. And sometimes those things can be associated with certain conditions, right? So that's a little bit different, but you didn't see all that. But then the child wasn't meeting the milestones that you would expect. So it does affect my practice. And it affects it so much to the degree that I've actually sought out on my own, how do I better equip myself to be able to help my patients when I'm concerned? And because we are seeing it so much, sometimes the resources are limited. So sometimes I can put in a referral for the evaluation for the concern of delay, but there's a long wait list before my patient can see that specialist. Okay, so there are pediatricians who are specialists in development. They've completed a pediatric residency and they've done a fellowship even beyond that to understand, manage, diagnose, and guide parents through treating some of these conditions, right, that are associated with delays. So, but because there's so, you know, few of them, unfortunately, and we're seeing a big burden of this problem right now, it can be a while before a patient might be able to see that specialist. So again, what do we do in the meantime? So we as general pediatricians have had to become, you know, better aware of what are the interventions that we can make. So that's the way it's impacted me. And I see it quite a bit. So autism, where we see deficits in communication, deficits in the way the child interacts, so relationships. We see repetitive behaviors and some issues with transition. Okay. So sort of, if I could say a one-liner, we start to see challenges in communication and the way that child interacts with the world, the way we expect. Well, just sort of a brief. So again, deficits in communication, deficits in interacting in relationships, whether it's, you know, people they know, people they don't know, and then sometimes repetitive behaviors or restrictive behaviors.
I know it can be very challenging. It definitely requires more resources, more time. About how many minutes would you say a typical patient encounter would be? And then does that change depending on if they have autism or any sort of delay?
It all depends on the reason for the visit, right? My schedule is built whereby I see a patient for a well child visit, maybe 15 to 20 minutes. Okay, it's the way it is. And if it's a sick visit, and you know, it also helps when you know the patient, right? So there's some rooms I walk in and I just say, hey, what's going on? What are we doing here today? And it's because I know the family. You know, I've seen the family, I've gotten to know them over a year or 2 years. Whereby if they're new to me for the first time, That's not the way I'm going. Hello, I'm so-and-so. Let me get to know you. Who does the child live with? Who do we have here today? You know, sometimes I'm asking, sometimes I ask my friend, so who's in the clinic here with you today? And they'll say, oh, that's my mom. That's my grandma. Oh, that's my dad. You know, so it just depends on the sort of the background. But I would say typically 15 to 20 minutes for a well child checkup. A sick visit, if I know the history of the patient pretty well, maybe 10 minutes. Okay. Now, if I have a patient who has a delay, it can be a little bit trickier. Number one, that patient can't communicate the way some of my, you know, my older patient might be able to. That might be a challenge. The other thing is they are very sensitive to things touching certain parts of their bodies sometime. So I, as a pediatrician, have to work with the parent to try to get the key parts of the exam that we need. And there are times I can't get it done. You know, we do the best we can. And I have to say, okay, what is most important out of this visit today? And then we'll say, we'll revisit this when they can come back in a few weeks, you know? So sometimes depending on the delay or if there's any other history of something, I can't address everything in that one visit. But the beauty of primary care is I can say, come back and see me next week. Come back and see me in 2 weeks. So I've alluded to the fact that I used to work in urgent care and, you know, that's not the way that works, right? But I can always say, okay, I haven't quite figured out what this is. I know you're safe to go home, but let's come back and talk more in a week or two.
Do you have social workers in the practice that can assist with more of the social issues that we're talking about?
Yeah, right? Good question. We do have a team that can help us, not in the clinic with me. So I work for a large hospital group in the area. And what we do is we do have a team of social workers that I can reach out to. Sometimes it's nice when they're right there in the clinic, and some clinics do have that. But I do have a team that I can reach out to. And it's also important for us to get to know the resources in the community. That's another reason why I am very keen on those kinds of things. I try to pay attention. If a family tells me, oh, you know, and maybe I'm meeting a family for the first time, actually like yesterday, and they let me know that, oh, he sees a counselor. I said, okay, where? Can you tell me? Because they love their counselor. So I take referrals from my patients sometimes. And I do that because it might help another family another day. And I love a referral. I can Google and come up with a list, but I don't know if these people are, you know, nice people. Are they going to take care of my friends?
Tell me how parents who might be listening can support their child's cognitive and emotional development. What can they be doing at home, checking on to help with your child's development?
An amazing question. And even as a mom myself, I struggle and worry with that. And I think because one of the things I want to first say is time with our children, spending time with them, especially, you know, at a young age, we're looking, you know, we guide their learning. Studies have shown that children who are what communication is in that household, the more words the child hears, it, you know, it can aid with their development. So if everyone is in their own room doing their own thing, no one's talking to my two-year-old is not going to be talking as much, right? But when you have, you know, someone who is heavily invested, spending time with them, working through puzzles with them, working with blocks through them, helping them to challenge, you know, the child's mind, that child is going to do better, okay? So I think time as a mom, because it's hard to find that time sometimes. Parents are working. Sometimes parents are working multiple jobs, also depending on if they are providing care for maybe a mother or a father, so the child's grandparent. So many things. But one of the things that we can do is to, number one, spend as much time with our children as we can. And even as they get older and they don't want to spend as much time with you, they want to spend time with their friends, make an effort to try to spend time with them. I bring this up, and I just had this conversation yesterday in clinic, the devices. That's why I say time. We need to put the devices down. We really need to. Sometimes I have patients who, and it was so amazing because my friend is the one that pulled up her phone and showed me the hours she spent on her phone. And I said, okay, we need to look at this and we need to think about how to minimize the screen time. And so it's one of the things I encourage my families to do is let's tell them to put the devices down. Let's go outside and play. Let's play a board game. And I tell them, you know, we live in Houston. The weather's not so bad, but so many weeks of the year, we can be outside. So I think time is really important. And I know it's hard to come by. I get it. I understand the stresses and the schedules of the world. But in those few hours that you have in the evening at home, put the devices away. Let's talk. Tell me about your day. And sometimes it's about how you ask, because even my kids, how was your school? How was school today? Fine. Okay, that's not the answer I need. So ask specific questions. Who did you eat lunch with today? Mm-hmm. Which special did you have today? And what did you guys do in art class? Or if they had music class, say, well, what did you guys do today? Did you sing or did you practice an instrument? So sometimes we have to have, you know, provide specific questions. So you pull it out of them. Yeah. Exactly. And then I'll tell one. Yes, go ahead.
I'll ask, tell me something interesting that happened today tell me something funny that happened today. And then sometimes my son is racking his, he's like, funny? Well, this is kind of, oh no, this was funnier. Okay, let me, you know, he's trying to give me the funniest thing that happened today. And I love that part of it where you make them, you have to pull the details out about their day, because a lot happens to them through the day and they don't have anyone to share it with unless somebody asks them, you know, so.
Thank you. You're exactly right. And then look at what that might strike up. That'll strike up a whole conversation. You know, when he can remember what the funniest thing was, then you'll say, okay, so what, you know, it can just lead to so many things. And then he'll remember the other things that happened during the day, because sometimes they just need their memory jogged too. And then they'll be like, oh yeah, and this, and this, and this, and this, right? But if we never started, then how do we get that out of them? And so I wanted to say this, because one more of them before we move on from this, sort of the idea about the devices. So sometimes my friends lose their device because they're on punishment. You know, maybe they did something wrong. So the parent will tell me, oh, yeah, they don't even have their phone right now. And do you know how the parents would tell me, you know, when we took the phones away, everyone came out of their rooms. We were in the living room together. We were, you know, we all, you know, so we really have to be conscious of what we're doing. It's hard. I get it. We're all so busy. We're working and it's very engaging. I mean, it keeps them busy. Not engaging, but it keeps them busy. Right. But we have to be careful, because we don't want them learning from some of these things that are out there. We want them learning from us. Right. You want to be the person that your child is learning from. And if you don't have the information, you reach out to the teacher. You get help. You reach out to the people.
Well, hey, so thank you so much for spending time with us today. And this has just been the most informative session ever. And it's coming straight from your heart. And you've got, so you know exactly what these parents are going through. I mean, unless you've got superhero children at home, they don't want to eat these vegetables either. They, you know, so we're all going through a lot of the same challenges with our children. So I think having a pediatrician like you has got to be very, very calming and rewarding for your patients, your friends, as you call them. So tell us where anyone who's listening, if they want to come to your practice, where can they come and find you?
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much again for the opportunity. And it's been fun to talk about the way we deal with everything that even as a mom myself, I'm dealing with. So know that you're not alone. Well, my name is Simi Ayeni, Dr. Ayeni, A-Y-E-N-I. And I am currently with Texas Children's Pediatrics, the Katy location. So it's off of Fry Road in Katy, close to where I-10 hits Fry Road. So that area of Katy is where I practice. I'd be happy to help out. I've been there for over 1 year now. And before that, I was with another primary care group. And before that, I was with urgent care. So I come with a little bit of experience in this.
A lot of experience. MD, PhD. So she's a physician and a scientist, guys. So you definitely have the best of both. She knows all the science behind everything that she is offering and recommending for our children. So thank you so much, Dr. Ayeni. Such an honor and a privilege to have you on.
Thank you, Dr. Foyer. It's been a pleasure. You guys have a wonderful rest of the week.
Tired of waiting at the ER? Lifesaver's 24-hour emergency room is your number one ER for pediatric and adult medical care. Staffed by board-certified physicians with absolutely no wait time, Lifesaver's 24-hour emergency room is equipped to handle life-threatening conditions quickly. Your emergency or concern is our priority, and we're here when you need us. From allergic reactions to concussions, migraines, slips and falls, car accidents, heat stroke, broken bones and sprains, sinus and ear pain, asthma attacks, and more. We have state-of-the-art equipment and technology with an on-site CT scanner and X-ray machines, as well as a full-service lab for immediate results and 24-hour pharmacy services. Our dedicated kids' corner keeps your little ones occupied while you are attended to. The pediatric room is specifically tailored to soothe your child and ease the stress of their medical condition. Worried about COVID-19? Lifesavers ER is Houston's go-to destination for rapid COVID-19 testing, treatment, and care. Our board-certified ER physicians and ER nurses will quickly get you the urgent care you need. Lifesavers 24-hour emergency room is your ER for immediate care. Now with 3 convenient Houston locations, open 24/7 to get you feeling better fast. Our Willowbrook area location is located at the intersection of Highway 249 and 1960. Our Heights area location is in the Garden Oaks Shopping Center at 3820 North Shepherd Drive. Our Summerwood area location is located off of Sam Houston Tollway at West Lake Houston Parkway.